Saturday night edition of the pod. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to maintain this level of enthusiasm. It's going to be a little shorter show tonight just because it wasn't really that interesting of a game. Cleveland came out, like I think a lot of us expected, 116-86, a 30-point blowout. Dan Feldman actually had an interesting stat that the last five 30-point blowouts in the playoffs have all involved Cleveland. And a bunch of them involved Cleveland and Boston, interestingly enough. Two of them in Cleveland's ledger last year in the Eastern Conference Finals. So where should we begin here, Daniel?
I think we should start with Cleveland just playing with greater effort. I thought you could see it in a couple of different places. One was certainly defensively, they were getting back better, but also they were focusing on the defensive rebounds. And one player who I think exemplified it was George Hill. I just thought he looked more engaged in this game. He was got a little bit of juice because he was playing well and getting shots to fall early. But that improved effort was, to me, a significant part. Not the only part, but a significant part of the win.
Yeah, you mentioned the transition defense. Boston got absolutely nothing in transition in this game. And when they did try to run, they weren't able to actually convert at all. You mentioned Cleveland's pressure, and they'll do this sometimes where they come out for the first 3 minutes of the game and pressure up. And I thought Hill did that, even picked up full court a couple of times. I thought the bigger thing, too, was just that Cleveland, because it was 20-4 after 7 minutes of this game. And, you know, I don't think Boston ever got it below 10 after that. And so 4 points in the first 7 minutes of the game, we've seen that Boston just is not the same team offensively on the road in these playoffs, where they are now 1-5. They had a 99 offensive rating coming in on the road, and through the competitive portion of the game, three quarters in this one, that might be even generous calling that competitive through three quarters, they only had a 91 offensive rating. And so I thought Cleveland did better by not taking as many mistakes, that's terrible, but not making as many mistakes. How about that? And Boston seemed to have fewer actions. They seemed to settle into ISO mode a little bit more easily. I thought that Lou, who we were critical of him going away from the offensive lineups, actually going with better defensive players helped because Boston was trying to ISO more. You know, they didn't have Korver and Love in there together where they're really able to take advantage. And then the other huge thing I thought was that LeBron James set the defensive tone for this team.
He was so much more active and engaged. We talked during the Twitter NBA show about how few help blocks or even primary defensive blocks he'd had so far in this series. He was there, transition, getting back a little bit more, and far fewer of those just like no-competes where, whether it was his guy or not, where something happens and he just kind of stands there and watches. And LeBron is such a tone setter for Cleveland on both ends of the floor. The other thing he added in, which I feel like we have to mention, is just the ridiculous collection of passes. He ended the game with 12 assists, but the highlight nature of, like, he made some passes through windows that were just incredible.
Oh yeah, I mean, those two lefty passes that he made that were like an inch away from the body of the big man defender for dunks for Thompson and for Larry Nance. The one where he drove down the left lane line, looked to be completely stopped, pivoted in the air and threw it all the way back to the right wing to J.R. Smith for a three. And Smith actually making some shots certainly was helpful to the Cavaliers in this game. I didn't think that he was, you know, his looks were so amazing all the time, but he actually made some, which was good. And then defensively, to go back to that, I mean, I'm not sure whether it was LeBron feeling like, hey, I got to get everyone else involved early. You know, I'm going to need more help. I got to involve them. Or whether it was a concerted strategy to say, hey, you know what? We're going to try and get Love in the post. We're going to try and get George Hill, Kevin Love, pick and rolls, and even like get J.R. Smith coming off some screens. And to let LeBron save a little bit more energy early to then defend more. I mean, there's a number of plays that I can think of that he had. I mean, he had one great closeout in the corner on Jaylen Brown after he was all the way over on the other side of the floor stopping a post-entry pass when they're fronting. He had that play against Al Horford where he stunted towards Horford, faked him out of taking the shot, and then knocked away his pass as well. He had the play where he was denying Marcus Smart and knocked it away, ended up getting a fast break out of that. There was the block of Aaron Baines off of pick and roll coverage that kind of broke down. Baines tried to go in for the dunk. James rejected him. And all of those were probably in the first 18 minutes of the game that I'm talking about it. And you would be hard pressed to come up with like even one play like that from the first couple of games. And so I think for Cleveland, the defense looked a lot better. James is the tone setter on that. And the offensive contributions they got from the likes of Hill, Love, Early, Smith helped a lot in allowing him to exert that level of energy necessary on defense, which, of course, we've been critical of in the first two games.
There were also some strange rotational decisions from Brad Stevens, most notably that in the early portion of the game, it seemed like he wanted to play anybody but Ojale. And that included Garrison Yabusele, who was not providing much value. He just, there isn't really a reason to have him out there. He's not agile enough to switch. He doesn't provide much offensively, and then he's not a good help defender. And yet he got first quarter minutes, and yes, Boston was technically plus two in those minutes, but that was not because of Yabusele, and that's, again, why plus minus is a weird stat. And also,
yeah, I don't know why you would ever use him over Ojale. Like, what advantage does he bring over Ojale?
Yeah, it's a big concern, and Ojale, I mean, especially in a series against LeBron James, I mean, he has the strength to make that work in a at a higher clip. I mean, he's certainly, Ojale's not perfect, but he can help out. And then I thought they went too much to Greg Monroe. The Cavs looked to be licking their chops offensively when Monroe was on the floor, and Kevin Love actually beat him on a straight line drive and forced Horford to help. I can't remember. I think Love finished over it and didn't get the end one. But Monroe has a place maybe in this series, but he's not kind of an early, he's more of a last resort than a first resort.
Yeah, I thought that for Monroe, it's something that Stevens will try to do sometimes when they just can't score, to try and get some sort of a presence on the post and on the boards. The boards were a major problem for Boston as well. They gave up 40% offensive rebounds through the competitive portion of this game. When you count also the team offensive rebounds, which I think there were three of early on. Couple other just examples of the effort plays that the Cavs made that they weren't making in the first two games. J.R. Smith went into a pretty dumb ISO move, spin move, tried to go off the glass on Tatum, didn't really create any separation, falls down under the basket, and then he actually sprints back hard and picks up Marcus Smart. I mean, it would be hard-pressed to imagine or recall a play where a Boston ball handler actually pushed it without just having like a clear two-on-one or something like that. We mentioned the offensive rebounds. I thought another thing too, which is actually I think a good sign for Cleveland, is they got called for a couple of holding fouls off the ball, like just on guys who are trying to come off of screens and shoot. And that's actually a positive indicator for them. They're actually like trying to make guys' lives difficult. And, you know, that's the sort of intensity this team played with, you know, back in their glory days in the 2016 finals.
Well, that ties in with something that has been a point of discussion at various moments, and I think I've made this a couple of times with Jokic, is that there are people who believe that not fouling is basically always a virtue on defense, but there are certain teams, and Cleveland in the regular season was one of them, where to me, not fouling was just a symptom of them being so far away from the action that they weren't doing anything. So just getting into guys is a positive indicator for where they are, though for other teams, of course, it wouldn't be.
Yeah, and I would be very interested to see what the correlation is between off-ball fouls and defense. I would imagine there might even be a positive correlation with that, just because the referees aren't going to call that every single time. Now, Boston did get a slightly rough whistle, although it was really more by the third quarter when the game was totally out of reach already that became more of an issue. But Jaylen Brown had a couple of fouls early, finished with five. It was odd to me, though, that he only played 12 first half minutes. And he only had two in the first half as well. I mean, he was their best player, I thought, in the first two games, giving them some offensive pace, pushing the ball. But when Jaylen Brown only has two rebounds, it's hard for him to be a grab-and-go guy. Boston, as a team, only 16 assists, which and it just seemed like because the Cavaliers weren't making as many mistakes, and then Boston also just wasn't able to get the matchup advantages that they had earlier, right? Remember in game one, it was Horford really going at Kevin Love. Horford only had four shot attempts in this game, ended up playing 30 minutes, so not too many after 22 in the first half, which I actually thought that was good from Stevens to play him more to try to get back into it early and then just kind of punt when they clearly weren't going to get back into it in the third quarter. But so Horford, you know, he tried to post up Tristan Thompson once, didn't really get anywhere. Korver wasn't really stuck on either Jaylen Brown or Jason Tatum that much. That was a matchup that they really went after when Korver was in the starting lineup early. So all these things are great for Cleveland, And you certainly you can point to, well, 17 of 34 from three-point range. And Korver was 4 for 4. Smith, 3 for 4. Hill ended up 3 of 9, but he hit a bunch early. I think he had three threes in the first quarter to really help them get out to that lead. LeBron was 3 of 3 from three-point range as well. He had an incredibly efficient 27 points on only 17 shooting possessions, 8 of 10 from the foul line, had those 12 assists, 2 steals, 2 blocks. But so 17 of 34 was good, but also the number of three-point attempts they were getting up, 11 in the first quarter, was big. And then Boston, they only, I think, had 4 three-point attempts in the first quarter.
Correct.
And finished 6 out of 22.
And Boston, sure, 6 out of 22 is worse than you'd expect them to do. And I think it should also be noted, though, that Cleveland did a much better job contesting their threes. The looks that Boston was getting in this game from long distance overall were worse. And, you know, they had a couple open ones, as you would always expect. Horford had a really nice one. And then, Marcus Morris had one where it was on an offensive rebound, I believe, and they got open. But I thought one of the other differentiators in this game, and I looked back on it, and it's been broadly true in these playoffs, is that I don't think he is the deciding factor, but it is worth noting that Terry Rozier hasn't played well in any of Boston's losses so far.
Yeah, and I think they're undefeated, of course, at home, and I think he's only had one good road game, and that was the game that they won in Game 3 at Philly. And even in that game, they couldn't really score at all. That one was in the 90s through regulation. See what else we have here. I mean, there's not that much to talk about.
Well, there's one thing that I want to say. I think that Boston should be encouraged that Jason Tatum looked more in sorts than in Game 2. You know, he didn't swing the outcome of this game, and he hit some twos that aren't always going to fall in, but he looked aggressive enough, and I thought he was doing a nice job doing some of the right things offensively. And Boston will need that moving forward, because Cleveland's offense, they were getting kind of hurt on both ends of the floor relative to my own expectations of this series. But assuming Cleveland has their offense kind of together and that some of what Boston was doing won't happen, the Celtics are going to need to score reliably, at least, but I would say well, in order to win. And that's going to require Jaylen Brown playing well, it's going to require Terry Rozier playing well, and it's going to require Jason Tatum, along with, of course, Al Horford.
Yeah, and maybe that's one of the adjustments for Stevens, is he's got to get more offense on the floor, I think, to some degree.
That's something else we should talk about that was really intriguing about this game, was that Al Horford played so many minutes in the first half. He was at 20,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, I mentioned that briefly. that they really wanted to get him, you know, to try to get back into the game by playing him a lot. But I would be interested to know how many minutes he played at center, because I didn't think that, you know, it's going to be hard for them to score, especially in these road games, unless he is playing center. But and I thought that playing Yabusele, Monroe, Baines a lot, that Brad Stevens kind of fell into the trap of Cleveland playing a traditional center pretty much all the time as well. Whereas he didn't do that in Game 2, but I think maybe a couple of offensive rebounds or something spooked him. And their first sub is always to get Baines into the game for either Brown or Tatum. And again, I'm not really sure why Jaylen Brown didn't play that much. I didn't see him making any major mistakes. Certainly, he wasn't as big a part of the bad shot brigade as guys like Smart, Morris, Terry Rozier were. I mean, those guys were taking some tough ones, and it wasn't like end of the clock either. You know, I think that was another thing, that they just didn't quite have the patience and didn't run through enough actions to make these Cavs teams make mental mistakes.
I think is one thing. Again, Marcus Smart was 2 of 8 in the first three quarters, and I remember both of those shots. They were both pull-up twos that we said on the show, oh, the Cavs will live with that. So those are his only 2 points, because he didn't get to the free throw line at all. And Smart, you know, if the Celtics offense is going to rise or fall at certain moments with Marcus Smart, they're going to be falling more than they rise.
Well, that had not actually been the case in the first two games, because Smart, despite not shooting particularly well, was getting into the lane and just killing them just with conventional pick and roll play. And one of the things they did to eliminate that was they actually put LeBron on Smart, which was something that I had suggested, in part so that LeBron could be more of a help guy. And I think that was effective, but also because then they could switch pick and rolls with Smart and Horford with Tristan Thompson and LeBron. And Horford still caused some issues with his pick and pop game, but he only got 2 3-point attempts up and only had 4 assists as well. You know, he wasn't really operating at the elbows as much as he normally does. So they did a pretty good job. They even were bringing another guy over on those pick and pops when they were playing it conventionally and not switching it, bring another guy over to Horford. And so I thought that worked pretty well. Another thing, just small notes here. The Cavaliers both did a really nice job of flipping the angle of the screen, whether it was Hill or LeBron as the pick and roll ball handler. Thompson was one of the best at this. And while you'd say, oh, what does it matter the way they screen? They're switching everything. Well, you still have to be in position to pick the guy up on the switch. And so if Thompson flips the angle of the screen at the last minute, LeBron can get a running start and the guy who's guarding Thompson can't switch onto him really quickly enough. And so they got a couple of nice plays where they got penetration off of that, either by Hill. Thompson also had a couple of nice flare screens as well where they weren't guarding him. Like, one thing we highlighted on Twitter was they got a mismatch of Rozier guarding LeBron, and then because everyone was so worried about helping, Thompson just sets a flare screen and they get Love a wide open three. I think it was either Love or JR. I can't remember, on the right wing. So also a couple other notes here. Larry Nance played really well in this game. He had three steals, brought some energy, even though he clearly doesn't look like he's 100% in terms of his leaping ability. I think that hamstring is still bothering him. Like, he's not just like crushing monster dunks even when he gets in position for a dunk. Jordan Clarkson got to shoot 11 times, mostly in garbage time. That was great for him. Hood was totally out of the rotation again. They did go with Clarkson some as the backup point guard, and I thought Boston didn't do quite as good of a job of attacking him on, you know, back screens. He didn't have any major defensive breakgrounds. Back cuts and back screens being set by his man were the big problem that he had in game two. So he at least avoided killing the Cavs, even though, you know, I wouldn't say he had a good game necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I would agree with that. And one stat that I've been keeping an eye on this entire series is Boston's half-court offense. They were over a point per possession in the first two games, significantly over. I think they were around 1.1 in both those games. 0.753 in game three.
That's bad.
Yeah, and so I would expect that to get better, but striking that balance, also getting out in transition when they can, and when Cleveland doesn't turn the ball over that much, I think they had 11 turnovers in the first three quarters. They were actually equal in that, and Cleveland's making a lot more of their shots. It's harder to run on them.
Well, so where do we see the series now? You know, this is the first time it's kind of looked the way I think you and I expected it to look. Just Boston is such a weird home-road disparity. It's really a completely different team, and oddly it's more offensively, it seems like, sometimes than defensively. Usually you'd think that defensively and in the effort categories, now maybe part of that is just, you know, Cleveland is playing harder at home, right, which they certainly did in this game. But this has the feel to me, normally you'd say, hey, you know what, if Boston loses game four, it doesn't matter, but because they're still, you know, going home 2-2, still historically a massive favorite. But man, I mean, if you're Boston, how good are you feeling after you just lost two in a row to LeBron James and you're coming back home for a game five? I mean, maybe you almost might feel better if you get to a game seven. But, you know, I think if it gets to be 2-2, it's at least a 50-50 series in my mind, if not Cleveland actually being fair. We'll see what the nature of this next game is. And obviously you don't want to write in that Cleveland is automatically going to win this next game. But this is actually, it was also interesting too, Danny. We have talked about a lot how Boston, and we even said it on the show, hey, watch out, Boston is really hard to blow out. Like, they keep fighting. They're able to make these amazing comebacks. We saw it in the Bucks series. We saw it in the Sixers series. We saw it all season long, no matter who they had in the lineup. But they really just never even got back into contact. Like, this game was over in, like, you know, end of the second quarter at best for Boston.
I think a big part of that is just that they don't have the offensive firepower right now. And they were able to come back, like, on the Sixers because they could use defense. But Cleveland is a different type of team to come back against because they're going to make a fair portion of shots, at least in Cleveland. And I think this series is going to come down to game five. Like you, I will not discount the possibility that Boston wins. But what is notable is that in all three games of this series, the team that was the better team on that night won pretty cleanly. And, you know, there's reason to believe that that'll be Cleveland in game four. Doesn't have to be. And, you know, game five is going to be a challenge for them. I mean, there's no aura or fear of the Garden for Cleveland. I mean, they've won there before and they have LeBron James. So I think Boston's going to have to pull out. They're going to have to pull out two really good efforts on both ends of the floor in order to win this series. They absolutely can. They were the better team in a majority of this series so far. But that precedent is complicated in terms of how we project this series moving forward.
A couple of small news items to get to. John Gambardella, who's probably the local guy who's breaking the most news about the Suns at this point, with Paul Coro not covering the team anymore. He's a radio host in Phoenix. He basically says the Suns 100% are going to take DeAndre Ayton. Interesting to see whether that actually holds or not, but I haven't known him to be wrong about the Suns necessarily. Certainly, you know, they're going to do their due diligence and all that, blah, blah. But with Kokoschkov, everyone is assuming that he's going to be lobbying for Doncic, but DeAndre as the local product who the Suns are certainly very familiar with. And of course, they have a need at center, although I would certainly caution against considering that with the number one pick. And in Washington, Jason Smith picked up his $4.45 million player option, which no one could have seen coming.
5.45.
Oh, I'm sorry. Wow. I was more concentrating on the intonation than the facts.
That million dollars matters to ownership, to be damn sure.
Yeah. Well, it could have been, a $1.45 million player option, and you probably would have picked it up, frankly, after playing very, very little this season. They got their money's worth out of him 2 years
ago. Yeah, they did. And the other piece of news I think we can discuss is just, I don't think there's a lot that we need to talk about it, but the awards finalists came out, and the only real intrigue there was, I was wondering who, because they picked three people for the six awards they announced, and the last MVP spot, we expected Harden and LeBron to get two. It ended up going to Anthony Davis over Giannis. I had Giannis third. I don't know if you did. I think you did.
Yeah, I can't recall at this point.
And then we expected it, but Dwayne Casey being a finalist despite not having a head coaching job right now.
Yeah, well, I'd like to congratulate him on that, much as the Toronto Raptors Twitter account did in what I'm guessing was probably a scheduled tweet, because they knew at least who was going to be a finalist long before. And then gambling may be legal, which will be interesting. I don't have a ton to say on that. I'm not really that interested in it, other than as it may affect the salary cap, but it's not going to be such a titanic amount that we can expect some huge bump like we saw with the new TV contract in the summer of 2016. There is still, which no one has an explanation for, like Windhorst wrote a long piece about this, and he's thinking that maybe some amount of money from the gambling, which the league has wanted 1% of the take, now they have gotten a little more reasonable with 0.25%, although it's still pretty much a blatant cash grab to do that. But Windhorst said maybe because that $7 million or $6 million cap increase for the summer of 2019 is based on projected gambling revenues, but that seems awfully specious to have that as the reason for such a big increase. So we still don't really know what that might be. And I think that's probably going to do it for today. We do not have a sponsor today,
I'll promote a couple of things. So if you haven't listened to it yet, my podcast with Sirit Sohi on Real GM Radio is out there. I also wrote a piece, something actually was a hearkening back to my early days at The Athletic. I went through the video of all 15 Warriors turnovers in Game 2 and explained kind of how and why they happened. And I thought it actually told a lot of the story of Game 2 with Chris Paul often helping off of non-shooters and a lot of those different elements that came into it and the turnovers there. And then I think I've had like four off-season previews come out for The Athletic. Suns, Knicks, Spurs, and I think one other one. So those are all available there. There's now a landing page if you go on any single one of them at the bottom going through. And I think we're somewhere around halfway now with those. So that'll all be coming out. And I'm excited for Game 3 of the Western Conference Finals tomorrow. It's going to be a blast.
Yeah, we will be back tomorrow night a little bit later on because we'll be at the game, so we got to come home and do the pod, but we're looking forward to that. And also, we're going to have more stuff on our Patreon, too. I guess we can have that be our sponsor, patreon.com/DuncanLarue. If you're still listening by this point and you want to get salary sheets, which are going to be massive, they're a great companion to our team previews, and also, obviously, we're going to be updating them in as close to real time as we possibly can, as close to real time as anyone that I know does, at least during the off season once we get there. So thanks so much for listening. Sorry for the short episode, but it was a short game. So we'll be back tomorrow night. Till then.